and there's never any rewards. You might look ahead and is there any reward after, yes, after a year of endless pain, a hatch opens, the scrawny iron breast, and says, here's the medallion. Is that all there is?
That's all.
That is not quite what I had in mind. That seems to work for others, but my case is different. I have more sophisticated needs, I guess. So the sixth step is a difficult step. I must become willing to have God remove all these defects of character. Either I must become willing to do what is necessary to remove them over a period of time. So that's really what I'm saying. Am I willing to do what is necessary? Am I again invoking the power of God to help me take actions that I am afraid of and want to withdraw from? So the sixth step is really not terribly complex, but yet it's a great dividing point. Two great turning spots in all of AA. Fourth step, where I'd say 75% of people who come to AA never take the fourth step, or maybe higher. In fact, when you stop to think about it, there's a someone in the big book, Bill, talks about there's more people, or there's 12, but anyway, talks about everybody in AA, there's some people out in the street who've been to AA. It is my experience, I would bet today that I bet there are 10 people or more who have been in AA and sober who are back drinking for every member of AA that's sober. I don't know any long-term drinkers, for example, on Skid Row, who haven't been to AA and been sober. I don't know. I know very few old, long-term drinkers who haven't been to AA somewhere along the line and been sober and come to the realization that AA does not work for them. And in almost every case, they've stopped at one of two turning spots. They've been sober, but they have stopped at a fourth step, or they stopped at a sixth step. Very few people have taken all the steps and have gone back out quickly. You can when you're an old timer. You can take all these steps, and eventually you go back out. We know how that works. But the actions, I have to take actions now that don't seem to apply to my problem sometimes in these steps, and they're frightening. Someone asked me to briefly an analogy I used one time when I was talking, and I sometimes use analogies that are so strange I can't even bear to think about them later, but this one was a good one. I was using it as an analogy about good and bad treatment centers. When I was new, there weren't any treatment centers. I know. Sanitarium, trying out spots. Over the years, treatment centers sprung up and changed of them and individuals, and some of them were good. And most old-timers hated them. Yeah, treatment centers! Ah! As the years went by, I noticed some people were doing quite well out of treatment centers. Some weren't. And good treatment centers are indeed a great help. I think statistics indicate if you've been to a treatment center and go to AA, your chances are considerably better than just going to AA or just going to a treatment center. Because at least you're sober in some possession of your faculties. When you get to AA, you've had some free learning. But what's the difference between the two treatment centers? And the analysis I used is like, why would people want to go to a treatment center today when AA is free and costs $1,000 for the treatment? It's like going down here to the lake and wanting to go to Cleveland. And here's a trim little yacht, skiff, scooter, called the SS Treatment Center. People in white, clean white uniforms. You want to come with us? We're going to. Shoving off in a minute. Smell of good food wafting out of the kitchen, out of the galley. It's just wonderful. Down the beach here, two guys kind of skulking around some tall grass and saying, you want to go with us? We're from AA. We got the invisible boat. Really, there's no great put down to say, I personally would prefer to get on the skiff, you know. I want to wish you a lot of luck, guys. And you go to the SS Treatment Center, and it pulls up, and it does exactly what it says to do. It keeps you warm, dries you out, gives you information about your problem, feeds you well, makes you well. Everything's great. only one problem with it. He just gets out of sight of land. He says, well, this is as far as we go. We're going to go back to get the next load. Well, what am I supposed to do? Swim like a sumbitch. And you start swimming, and here come these two fools buying their invisible boat. You want a ride? I'm not that sick. Pretty soon you're almost drowning. And finally you're almost dead, and come by again. All right. Okay. I pull you in. What do you want me to do? Get an oar and row. You crazy bastard. And the irony is, as you start to row, the boat appears. But it doesn't appear until you start to row. So you have to be kind of desperate. As you start to row, the boat appears. It gets bigger and better. Much finer than that little skiff. You don't even want to go to Cleveland. You just want to stay in the boat. Hell, let's turn this way. Hey, hey, hey. Great. And that's great. That's why we have sponsors. They come every once in a while. You slow down. What's wrong?
You got your oar upside down.
Okay, go ahead. One of the reasons we get together at these meetings is to remind one another to keep rowing. To keep rowing. That's what we do. There's no new information here after a while. You can just keep rowing. Reinforce that. Keep rowing. God will help you row. Keep rowing. When you're tired and the rain is falling and you're cold, row. It's better. And that's fine, except for one thing. We see it around us. I hope it never happens to me or you. But you can stop rowing, you're on a great thing. If you stop rowing long enough, the boat starts to disappear, little by little. We've all watched old-timers who have had big ships, and they're back in the water, and they can't understand it. Jack and I were talking on the way over here from the airport about old-timers we have known who have gotten drunk and couldn't get back. I'll tell you why they can't get back. I will do anything to get back to my big ship. But you can't have your big ship back. You got to row and start with a little boat again. Don't want to do that. I know about that. I'll get back. And they die. That's why it is. People, usual a rule of thumb, relatively accurate, I suppose, that if you've been sober over 7 or 8 years, and you get drunk, the chances of you getting back are remarkably slim. Some people do, but it's very rare because they want to get back to a big ship. And they can't. Now, what's this got to do with treatment facilities? Well, there are treatment facilities who, in my opinion, are almost literally killing people. As I said earlier, they haven't taken 12 steps. They read intellectual literature. They get psychoanalyzed. They get the bonding with their counselor. And they leave the facility thinking that they have recovered. And they now can do it. And if you have troubles, call your counselor, call aftercare. But, I mean, if you want to go to some place like AA, that's fine. But you have enough information to stay sober. And they literally kill people like us. The good treatment centers say, look, you got information, you're dry, you're feeling good. Now we're leaving you in the water. For God's sakes, when those two pukes come by in the invisible boat, jump in. Right now. You don't have to believe it, just do it. The ones that guide us into AA are prized beyond belief. The ones who, for their own reason, for money-making or pride or ego, would lead you to believe that your information will make you well, will kill you. And I think that's what most of the things we do. And some of the great, one of the great problems we have to face when we first get in the boat is rowing through a fourth step. It doesn't even have any reason for doing it. And rowing through six steps, which gets us apparently someplace we don't want to be. But all the things here are designed to little by little bring about a goal we never could have conceived could happen based on our intellect. We'll talk about a little bit more about it tomorrow morning. But what is the goal of all of these steps? To make you wonderful? No. To make you above human? No. To make you without emotion? No.
is to very, very slowly do what alcohol does fast. To little by little take people who are not enough and make them feel most of the time like they're enough. To take people who live with fear and most of the time live without being terrified. To little by little take people who feel highly vulnerable and most of the time feel invulnerable, or at least not highly vulnerable. And it's hard to explain that to new people because there's just no way to get from here to there. It's hard to do that even in the sixth step when you're that far along. But at least when you've taken the sixth step, you have now accepted the premise, there is a way for me to go, and I'm in the middle of doing it, and I'm going to keep trying. And what we can do as individuals is remember to take those steps, and what we can do as sponsors is to guide people into taking them. Love will not keep people sober. Spirituality will not keep people sober. Not alcoholics of my type. You know, the insight, I mean, these are all great adjuncts. Always the interesting example of that. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob meeting on Mother's Day in 1935. And Dr. Bob was already a spiritual leader in the Oxford group in Ohio, but still was drinking. Bill Wilson was a member of the Oxford group for 6-7 months in New York. And they got together for 2 weeks in Dr. Bob's house and discussed spiritual values and spiritual breakthroughs and insights and God's will. And Dr. Bob got drunk. And when he sobered up this time, they realized that is not Bill Wilson stayed sober. He stayed sober by trying to help people on the streets of New York. So they went up and went to the Akron Hospital and found AA number 3. And the three of them went and found AA number 4. And they find our book. It says, action is the magic word. You must take the actions. The spiritual adjuncts are what come with it. But most of us would like to find a way to not do the action, but to bury ourselves and say, well, I'm just finding the spiritual concepts. I don't want to be done with that crass stuff. That's meaningless. That's just another nice way, in my opinion, of an easier, softer self-obsession. Getting out of self. Self-obsessed people getting out of self. People who have spent their whole lives trapped in conflicts between their inside and outside. I got certain techniques and people don't like it, but God damn it, they enable me to survive. Now you want me to give them up? Got to be willing. Give it a try. Maybe it'll work. Thank you. You want to come up and say a few words? What?
I'm going to say a few words.
Oh, I was talking to her, but if you want to, that's okay.
Hi, everybody. I'm Maggie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Maggie.
I just want to thank Clancy for a beautiful morning, for beautiful sharing.
We were going to have a little discussion on the step.
Well, that's what I was going to sort of do a group conscious about. We were going to wrap up by 11, but I'm quite willing if you want to have about another 10 minutes of discussion is just fine. Discussion or sharing? Okay.
Well, I wanted to get back to my room and worry.
Who would like to kick it off? Tom.
This is just steps, which I love to say. So, because you're willing to have God agree to do that, humbly ask Him for wisdom. And then it goes on if you read the chapter, but it has nothing to do with God. It's you got to do it. It seems to be a bit of a scam here. You know, seriously.
Yeah, but don't tell the newcomer.
It's been pointed out to me, and I noticed this right from the very beginning.
That's right. Well, my answer to that would be, let me talk in the microphone, this may be deathless, I'm not sure yet. The question is, why is it in the sixth, seventh separation we say, we ask God to do these things, and then it turns out we have to do them? I think the answer to that, Tom, is this. What I'm saying in effect is, I have to do them, but I have to do them by taking actions that I don't always believe in. I am turning myself over to the care of God as I understand it. I am taking actions that I would not take based on my own intelligence or self-evaluation. You understand that? I'm asking God to do this. What I'm saying in effect is, God, I'm going to take these actions of yours even though I don't always believe them. So I'm asking God to do it, but I must do it. But I must do it by taking actions that I do not believe in sometimes. I must, in other words, I am again asking God to do something for me that I have to do for myself, but I would not do without the security of His person, His being. Is that too abstract? Do you understand that? Let me put it more clearly. I know that. I remember having that feeling years ago. Why even bring God into it? I just have to do it. I'm asking God of myself. I would never ask anybody to remove my defects, all of my defects of character. Some of them maybe, but not all of them. I have to ask God. That is the surrender. I'm going to ask God to help me become willing to surrender my defects of character. Now, I would not do that of myself. I'm asking God to help me do it. Help me become willing. Because of myself, I would never become willing. And the seventh step, which I'm going to talk a little later about, ask Him to remove these defects, is I'm not sure that I want them removed, but I'm surrendering to God. In other words, I'm asking God to do something that I'm afraid to do on my own. And to bring this about, I have to take actions. It's just like asking God to get me, God, help me get to Toronto. But I have to start moving. But I'm asking God to help me. Ask me. God, I think one of the great prayers in the 12th step, or the 11th step, that I think is the most impressive prayer of all the prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous, the one I've stuck with the most, praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the strength to carry it out. Because otherwise I get into dickering and promising and manipulating. But that's what I'm doing there. I'm saying, God, help me remove these defects of character. Help me to stay willing to do it. Help me to override my own damn selfishness and self-centeredness long enough to occasionally do something that'll get me out of it. Now, I am doing it, but I'm asking God for the power. Is that clear? Well, not to me. Yeah, it is. It is. You have your hand up? I thought you were taking your pulse. Well, as I understand the fear, it's the fear of the little boy. If I say I got a toothache, I'm going to have to go to the dentist for the next 18 weeks. I would say that the defects of character we use as tools, in my experience, have been predicated on the fact that of myself, I am not enough. I always need a little edge to win. In other words, I cannot win based on myself. I got to have some extra going for me. So I use little tools, little shortcuts, little hustles, little deals and now they want me to give up those things and operate just normally, straightforward. And that is frightening to me because I don't think I'll be enough to do it. And that is what I think over a period of time you discover in age to the best of your ability, you try to give up those things as much as possible, and you operate straightforward and you operate without guile, and it seems like you're just highly vulnerable. You know, it's like you say you're having a bad morning and I'll slip away to a noon meeting. But I know if I do that, that's the very time my competitor will get a big sale and I won't. I better sit here. And it's hard to realize that. I'll tell you an example of that. My sponsor, Chuck C. If you ever read this, he did this Paula Mesa retreat where he talked about it at length in the book, New Pair of Glasses. But that's a good example of it. Where he, after he was sober a little while, he decided that he would just run his business straightforward and honest. And he would do whatever necessary to be a good businessman. I mean, he designed the insides of supermarkets. And he had a couple of examples where the guy said, I don't like this. He said, okay, I'll do it again for nothing. It's going to cost me thousands of dollars, but I'll do it again. Because I want to do it to make you happy. And his fellows in the business were saying, hey, we're in deep, you know, you keep doing this, Chuck, and we're out of business. We can't do it. But as it turned out, he did it this way, and he couldn't handle the business after a while. He was turning away business. He became a multimillionaire by not having an edge. When he had an edge, he was just fairly well-to-do. When he became straightforward, he became a multimillionaire. Now, I'm not saying that if you conduct yourself as an honest citizen, you become a multimillionaire. But I would say that being a multimillionaire was not as important to Chuck as sleeping well and feeling good. And that's what you get to. You sleep well and you feel good. I run a mission on Skid Row, as you know. Some years ago, I resigned a job in Beverly Hills where I was quite successful, and I run a mission on Skid Row. I get paid considerably less than I might make in the real world. And it's a funny thing. People drive their Mercedes and their BMWs down to talk to me at the mission on how to feel comfortable. They could all buy and sell the mission I work in. But what good does it do if you can't sleep at night and you feel terrible? What we have in common, what I haven't, you know, over the years I had a chance to sponsor a lot of people. The guy who put the flag on the moon, and movie stars, and priests, and psychiatrists, and bums. What we all have in common is that we've all come from a field where sobriety is untenable, and drinking is untenable. And we have to take techniques to get rid of it, and stopping drinking is not enough, so we have to work on sobriety, as we've talked about the last few hours. We have to give up things that seem to be the only defenses we have against the world. And I don't think any one of us are ever in any danger of becoming perfect or wonderful. I don't think it's because it's just not the human condition. But I must be willing to try to be straightforward. To me, as I mentioned last night briefly, some of the greatest spiritual concepts I've ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, the things that changed my life as much as anything I know, are things such as, do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be, when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not coming. Don't take out your pent-up hostilities on people who can't answer back, such as your children, waiters and waitresses, employees, you know, where you just pent up, and most of us have been in the habit, come home and just, it's been crap the other day, you got to take that crap. But don't take it from a kid. Get to your room! And you got to try not to do that. I remember telling my sponsor, I was kind of news. I said, She said, I know you've seared me taking it out on the woman serving coffee at the club, and she's just an employee. God damn it, give me the coffee! You got to learn not to do that. I said, I've got to get it out. He said, there's Mike Ross. Mike Ross was a guy 6'6", big ex-football player. He said, go over and tell that Mike Ross. I said, you better will. I believe I can stuff it after all. But it's so easy to slide into that cheap gratification of taking it out on people who can't answer back. If you want to take it on someone who can answer back. Take it out on an equal or someone superior. And it's amazing how your attitude changes. But these are the great spiritual values of me. Operating decently. Another thought, you know. trying to wish for people what you wish you had could get. Jeff, I talked about it earlier. But all the things that go into it. I don't think there's any danger in the sixth step that you and I are going to become saints. But we have to become willing to try to take care of these things as they crop up. I hope that answers your question. I don't know any better way. I might as well go eat lunch after a while, huh? I welcome you back from your meaningful discussion meetings, back to the droning harangue. Pay for your sins. Let's see, we've taken the six steps. First, we admit we're powerless over alcohol, and our lives have gotten management. There might be a power greater than ourselves. Somehow to restore us to living without alcohol, and we're in theory going to try to turn our lives over to that power, even though we don't see how it can be done. And first major steps are taking an inventory and exposing ourselves with fear and trepidation, and reading it to someone else, and then that big step of making a decision. Try to become willing to ask God to remove these defects of character, which brings us up now to step number 7, which is the shortest step of all the steps, only 7 words, but it has one of the great connotations, one of the most meaningful of the steps. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Just in passing, it's kind of a funny thing about alcoholics. Years ago, I remember going to a discussion meeting where they spent an hour discussing what's the difference between defects of character and shortcomings. What is which? And then later on I read in Bill's writing where he said he just didn't want to be redundant in the two consecutive sentences that mean the same thing. But we all like to argue, debate. We always like to find mystical things and very simple things. There's something here we don't see in it. They're keeping it from us. That's the theory of some of these philosophers I see now in transactional analysis and so on, in my opinion. Of course, I have no opinion on it. It's not anything to do with AA. But they make millions of dollars by having people think the answer is just out of reach. Just come back again. And you buy the literature and attend these hideous, and if you ever listen to them, they're just are meaningless. It's just. But Alcoholics Anonymous isn't that way. Alcoholics Anonymous, Frank, no talking when you speak.
Sorry, sir.
If you must speak, it's okay to loudly say, "Isn't he wonderful?" But let it go.
And how about humbly?
I'm going to take up humbly. Oh, I don't want to do that. Let's go on to the next step. But humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. We're going to now, we became willing, try to become willing, ask God to help us become willing. Then we become willing to do that. And what we're doing, that is the first place, I think, in the steps, of course it is, where we get into humility. Humbly, humility. And humility is always one of our goals. It's always a question. What is humility? Is it Uriah Heep? Is it somebody just standing there saying, "Oh, you ran over my shoe with your car. I hope I didn't hurt your tire." mix it up with humiliation. But it is little by little, I've come to believe that humility is a very, very, it's an effervescent thing. After you've been around a while, even when you got it, you don't know you got it. You only know you haven't got it when you haven't got it. It seems to me humility is that rare ability of somehow being able to be yourself and figure that's enough. Just being yourself, not having to have a front, not having to have an image, not having to have them think. And nobody can maintain that very long, I don't think. But we sometimes talk about newcomers coming to AA, and we say they're arrogant. We've got to tear down that wall and bring them to humility. And really, you'll discover it's the other way around. Because this pride they have is nearly always an overcompensation for feelings of inadequacy, of not being enough. But you build up over the years this wall of apparent ego and arrogance, and you can believe it sometimes yourself, that you really are superior, except when it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you gaze into the darkness and want to commit suicide. But when your rational powers are going strong, you can believe that I really am. I'm too good for this stuff. I'm not. But it's been my experience that if you want to help people get humility, you build up their ego. You build up their self-worth. You have them take actions that build them up. Because as they build up, the compensatory wall comes down little by little. And little by little, you work yourself up to humility. You work yourself up to where you feel that what's inside of me is enough. It may not always very long, you may think of that, but that's what I believe humility is. Or just being me is enough. Or I don't have to prove something or convince you or have an image or a facade. But of course humans can't live like that, because part of living in the world is living with a facade where you don't show your emotions, as we talked about earlier, or when you're angry, you can't always afford to show anger, and you can't afford to show sorrow, and you can't afford to show a lot of things. You have to live behind a wall. But it's a nice few moments once in a while when you find that you can be yourself, that you don't have to have an agenda other than being yourself. And I think that's what refers to in this step, of course, as most of us know, Bill was so concerned about making sure that we did this as in an imploring method to diminish that wall of arrogance, that is, the step was originally written, it was written humbly on our knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, and he shook him. But then, in the editing, before it went to press, they took out the phrase, on our knees, because they thought it might sound religious. And so they just humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. But that's what he wants us to do. Humbly, as ourself, putting down this wall of arrogance to live, to ask for some way to take up and remove these shortcomings. Now, as we talked about this morning, there's no way human beings, you can't get rid of your shortcomings. You can't get rid of your defects of character all in one fell swoop. It would be nice to do it. We're talking at lunch. Unfortunately, we're talking while we're eating, so it lost a little something. I went to a different table. I didn't attend with my dinner companions. I went to a different table. We talked about it. There is a concept, I don't know about it, and we were talking about the table. That cleaning up your defects of character is, you take care of them as they come up. You look at them as they come up. It's like clearing a cesspool or a septic tank. You take this out, which enables some more things to float up. Oh, Jesus. And it's just an endless job. Pretty soon you want to go in the house. I think I'll get the rest of that next season, or the season after that for sure. Which reminds me of something. This is no time to say it, but I know I'll forget it, because other people in my room forget it. If anybody knows where there's a plunger around here, I can use it. I asked one of my office mates, bunk mates, to get one for me. He went to the desk up here and said, I'd like, and he forgot what he's asking for. He had to come back. And you have him defend you in court someday. So yeah, that was fun. Oh, I meant to say he's not guilty, Your Honor. I forgot. He may like the penitentiary, sure. But we humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings, to little by little work on the things. And as Bill says in the 12 by 12, humility has not had an easy time of it in our society. And it really hasn't, because there's so many emotions that we have to deal with, the negative things that the Humility is always kind of put down. Humility seems like kind of a emotion. We believe in things like pride. Take pride in yourself. And all of us can work on pride, but most of us have come here with a great deal of pride and we've been destroyed by it. I suppose, but pride is, even on the walls of clubs sometimes they put down things you want to get rid of. Despair and gluttony and lust and false pride. So that implies there must be some good pride somewhere. You never see a sign saying get rid of false lust, false hatred. Pride is sometimes, I think, confused because we equate it with self-worth. And I suppose in a sense it is. But pride, again, is something where we try to pull ourselves to be just a little bit more than we are, which I suppose is a very good thing. But humility is that rare occasion when we try to be just what we are. And if you are, it goes back to this again, if you know you're humble, then you're not humble. If you feel you have humility, you don't have it. It's something that comes when you don't even think about yourself. You see it in retrospect. Well, I had some humility. I was myself. I was thinking about others and not concerned with my image. So the seventh step really is not terribly complex. It's quite simple, but it's very difficult. Because I am now signing that agreement in principle I agreed to in the sixth step where I said, yeah, I'm going to agree in principle to sell it, and now, or to buy it, and now there's something, I'm going to put my name on there. I'm going to buy it. When I have people write an inventory, and I ask them to take their fifth, sixth, and seventh steps, one thing I always ask them to do, despite taking out the steps, I ask them to kneel in the bathroom, or kneel in the kitchen, or someplace where there's a hard surface, and nobody can see them, and ask God to help them truly become willing to remove these defects of character, and the next day to do that same kneeling and ask him to remove my shortcomings. I know no tongue of fire is going to come down and cleanse me, but I'm going to become willing to take that crap as it comes to the surface and at least give it a try. And a lot of it I may not be able to get in the first swing, but I'll get it little by little. And I got to be willing to do it. That's, I think that's what they mean when they say, as the years go along, the road gets narrower. It really gets more comfortable, but you're picking up more crap and throwing it aside. You're able to, at last I'm able to get rid of this thing. And at last I'm able to get rid of this thing. I see how meaningless and how painful this has been, and I thought it was bringing me happiness. That's over a period of time we do that. Then we get to the end of that step, and we've made a decision to, and decided to ask God to remove these defects of character. And you get to a couple of the steps that I think are really the most gratifying of all the steps, although sometimes they're very difficult. And that is the eighth step, of course, the eighth and ninth step, the eighth step where we have to make a list of all persons we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And that is easy for something. I mean, yes, there are some people here that I've hurt, and I don't mind saying I'm sorry to them. But there's a lot of other people who've hurt me worse than I hurt them. Where's the step where somebody makes an amend to me? Where's the step where something does right for me? When some of these people, they've ruined my life, some of them, it seems to me. They're just like terrible things. There's an interesting concept in dealing with the eighth step and how you deal with all of these things where people have hurt you, and you have to decide which ones you have to make an amend to. And I think it sounds difficult on the surface, but what a remarkable help it is if you can do it. And that is, you go into it by saying, I'm going to start off by forgiving everybody who has hurt me. I'm going to forgive everybody who has hurt me. They're all forgiven. And you can do that to a point easily, except for four or five people that we're still going to get. And some of these things they've done are unforgivable, and I can't expect you to forgive those. But you've got to try to be able, little by little, to forgive everybody. Then you can look at the list consciously and say, I have to make a list of people I've hurt.
Now, the question is, what do you mean by hurt? To me, that has always meant they have felt worse as a result of me. Financially, emotionally, spiritually, anyway. If I have made them feel worse, I have hurt them. And they must certainly be brought up for review. I think one of the good things about taking an eighth step with a sponsor, for example, is many times a sponsor can look at it dispassionately and say, what seems to be an amend that you need to make here is not really an amend you need to make. What seems to be a justified resentment is the one you have to make. It's always been my experience in making up this list of people that one group nearly always goes out there. And they are the group from the fourth step of people I resent. Nearly everybody I resent, I feel guilty towards in some way, I discovered later. Through one way or another, one of the reasons I maintain that resentment is I think as good an example of that is in everything I've done with people who take an inventory. Now, it isn't always the case, but nearly always. That's the only thing I've asked them to save out of their inventory. Take the rest of it and burn it. But take the resentments, and we'll talk about that later. The resentments should at least be very carefully analyzed. Despite what they have done to me, what have I done to them? Because as we said this morning, people aren't really against me. They are for themselves. And I'm interfering with that. Just as I am not against people, only if they interfere with me, with what I want or what I desire, or as I perceive them doing something to hinder my wants. Are you going to make a list of people you've harmed? It's very quite simple. And the reason to do this is not to become good, but because we get tired of living in disharmony. When you're living with continual ongoing resentments and feelings, and there's always disharmony, of course. So you're going to try to find some form of harmony. So you make a list, and you I know on my list in my eighth step, things I didn't have in my fourth step, I had my resentments, my sponsor made it with my father. And my father, I always felt, had partially ruined my life when I was a boy. He had left my mother and I, and he'd married another lady. And I'd never seen a divorce before that. I lived such an insulated life. And not only that, but he always wanted to make demands of me. He always wanted me to do more than I was doing. I had all sorts of reasons why he ruined my life. Partially. It was one of the reasons I could always feel victimized. That's incidentally, one of the things that very cunning and baffling and powerful about this list. Sometimes you have to put people on there who you feel have victimized you, because you'll never get rid of the victimization unless you find a way out of this, in my opinion. But my sponsor said, why don't you put him on your list? I said, because he has hurt me much worse than I've ever hurt him. He said, the point is that whatever he did, you were a rotten son. You were not a good son. He may have hurt you first, but he may have had reasons for doing that, but you had no reasons to punish him. I hadn't talked to my father for 10 years when I wrote this list. And I never was going to talk to him again, if I could help it. So I thought he was he made me put that down. He made me put down employers that had screwed me around, that I had to go back. One of the things that put on the list that's kind of strange is, there are people I have hurt who I can't make amends to. I can't make amends to my grandmother. She's dead. Can't make amends to an old guy that lived down the street who I hurt badly, not really badly, but hurt badly if it bothered me. And I can't, but you put them all down. Kind of a long list after a while. And you must, then you at least, in theory, are willing to make amends to them all. It's not a matter of some spiritual fervor. It's a matter of making amends to them. And that really There isn't anything mysterious about the eighth step. You put down things, the people you resent, the people you've hurt, all these things, and we all know that. I mean, there's nothing in a step seminar, all of us are knowledgeable to that. That's all there is to it. There's nothing spooky or miracle or miraculous about it. In the ninth step, we try to make these amends. And usually it's nice to have the help of someone, like a sponsor, to see what is meaningful and what isn't. Some of the difficult amends are, for example, not difficult, but I mean they're mechanical, but they're still a little difficult. It's like amounts of money that you can't pay. To call up that collection agency and tell them where you are and what your real name is. Because I've never had to deal with them. I've often thought, well, I've used this as one of the examples why drinking was so good. I remember once upon a time in El Paso, living in El Paso, Texas, the household finance, who's the friend of every alcoholic, I just done another consolidation loan which buries you deeper. There's never any way out of those. And they were, I was unable to make the payments for a while. His money had to be spent for other reasons, for my indulgence. And my wife and I were waiting around the house for them to call. There was some talk about they were going to repossess some furniture. And we had little kids. And I was trying to hold a job, and this would not look good for this executive to have his furniture repossessed. And when we were waiting for the phone to ring, my wife was just... And I was... And I happened to think I had brought home some rum. One thing about living in El Paso, across the river in Juarez, you can get rum cheap, and it's good rum. That's where the term rummy comes from. After a while, you just kind of... you don't have to drink much anymore. You just kind of stay there. But I went and got some rum, and I offered my wife a drink. I tried to be pleasant. I said, do you want a drink? She gave me that same intolerant, nastiest, of course not! Think you want to be like you? Children. I took a couple drinks of rum, and by the time the phone rang, I was the only one in the house who didn't have any compunctions about answering it. Listen, you keep up this crap, we're not going to borrow for you anymore. Now stop calling me, goddammit. But now I'm sober, I don't have that way to go. Hello. I'm working 12 golden steps to recovery. Will that work as payment? No, it won't. So if you're willing to go to people and say, I'll pay you $5 a week. And they say, that isn't very much. But if that's all you got, we'll take it. I've never heard anybody send the $5 back. And make amends to people that sometimes it's very difficult because they don't. You'd like to make amends and have them say, you're so wonderful. You've come here and made amends. You're just wonderful. And sometimes they don't do that. I went all the way back to Dallas to a big advertising agency, and I made an amends to a guy. I went to see him, and I said, I came here, I had a hard time getting in to see him. I'd been one of his better men at one time, I thought. See, I want to come in, I make it. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to make amends for the problems I gave you here. Well, what are you doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, I guess I'm an alcoholic. I never thought you were an alcoholic. I said, well, why do you think I did these things? You know, this stealing the company truck and wrecking it and little thing. I thought you were a son of a bitch, and I still do. And I almost had a new amend to make. I was going to punch him in the face. But then I did. I walked up. You make amends like that, and it's, I remember my making amends to my father. Oh, my sponsor said, write him a letter, tell him you're sorry you're a bad son,
and you hope, you wish him well. And I wrote the study, and he did something that I learned from, and I've done it ever since. He said, "Let me read it before you send it." And I read it and said, "No, no, no, that's a revenge letter. Do it over." And so I did it over. Finally, he accepted it. I sent it. And I got no, very little response. I don't think I got, I guess I didn't get the response from my father. He said, "Well, send him another letter and ask him if he got the first letter." And you just see this tall, strong, imposing, frightening man take my letter and ripping it up. I thought, that son of a bitch. I'll write him another letter. I'll tell him. Let me see it. So he sent another. And he wrote me back a letter. He said, "Yes, I got your letter." I didn't know what to make of it for his son because it sounded so unlike you. I thought maybe you were drunk. But he said, "I hope you're doing well. I know we've had our upsets, but I hope you're doing well." I thought, well, that's nice, but it isn't much to show for the years he hurt me. And a couple of years later, or a year later, my sponsor made me send him birthday cards and Christmas cards. And a year later, I had to go to Minneapolis to a convention where I was working. I was about 2.5 years sober then. I was working in this big medical corporation. And I lived 90 miles away from there, so I made the arrangements to go down and see my father. I said, "I'm going to come down and see you." And I just, it was difficult. I went down there. There's this house. And I didn't like his wife. I hated her. I didn't. This tall, imposing, threatening guy. I rang the doorbell, knocked the door. The door opened. And there was no tall, threatening, imposing guy. There was a short little guy. "Oh, son, how are you? So glad you're feeling better." I said, "What happened to that big guy that used to push me around?" I don't know. But anyway, I wasn't thrilled with my father, but at least we talked. We sat and talked. And from then on, we talked a little bit more, and after a while, I made a point. My sponsor suggests this, and I do it to people, too. Treat him like I was a good son, whatever I think. Just act like a good son from now on. And there never was a week after that I didn't call him. Didn't have much to say sometimes. Whenever I got that area, I stopped in and saw him. Didn't like his wife very well, but she died early, so that helped. Get a break here and there, what the hell, you can't fight. I came home and was a source of strength to him at her funeral. Got him through that. And we had to be quite close, actually. Like his declining years, he lived at our house. And we were closer than most fathers and sons I ever knew. And when he went back to Wisconsin, because he got lonely for his old friends and old fools that he was associated with, and old Norwegians and the old Norwegian church, that when he died, I was holding his hand, and he gave my hand a little squeeze and died. That's just a nice, nice, wonderful thing, isn't it? But it all because I made an inventory to some, I made an amend to someone who didn't deserve it. If I wouldn't have been forced to make that amend, I wouldn't have made that in 10,000 years of myself. Then they talk about making amends to, how do I make an amend to my grandmother, who was dead for 10 years by the time I started making amends? And for taking her money, her little money she had, and said, "I needed some money bad to get some to drink," and treating her with apparent love, but always trying to worry how I could hustle her for something. And my sponsor gave me an assignment on that, which I've in turn given to many people. You have to spend a lot of time from then on. You got to look for little old ladies who are having a difficult time somewhere as you go around your rounds, and stop and help them. Again and again, up some old silly lady out of the store with her bags. "Here, can I give you a hand? Can I give you a ride? Can I do something for you? People I know, some people I don't know. I think of that in the theory of making an amend to the world for what I've done to a lady I can't make an amend to. So I make an amend to somebody else like her on a continuing basis. I've done that with old men and old women and sponsors and all sorts of things. I make a special point of going out of my way to being of some sort of help for them to make an amend because I can't make the amend I should make, so I make it to the world in her name. In other words, I made a donation in my grandmother's name to that old lady or that old man or that old situation. There's all sorts of amends you can make. And I'll tell you what, to me, one of the great realizations of amends, the great goal of amends. I have never made a sincere amend to anybody that I ever really hated afterward. I've made a lot of amends to people I've hated. And I was forced to do it. But after making those amends, I didn't hate them anymore. I didn't always like them, but I never brooded about them anymore. I never hated them. It's the funniest thing in the world. Me making an amend to them enables me to stop hating them. It's one of the strangest phenomena in all of AA that I know. And so we go around making amends. Sometimes as you go along, you find amends 2 years later that I had never thought about. Think, I should do that. To stop and take the time to set things right as you can. I don't know, as I said this morning, at the end of the fifth step and the end of this ninth step, I think are the two great apparent moments of gratification of all the steps. They all have kind of a spiritual growth, but at the end of the fifth step, there's a feeling of well-being, and there's a great feeling of well-being at the end of the ninth step, because they both consist of doing something outside of myself and adding to the harmony of my existence. And I think it is not a surprise that at the end of the ninth step is where Bill Wilson has put the promises in the book, where it talks about if you do these things, because these are the six steps, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, the six steps where we try to clean up this crap that we agreed to do in the third step without knowing what we had to do. And before we get into the things that we do on a continuing basis, these are cleaning up the cesspool and sweeping up the crap and dreadful little crappy jobs, but that begin to get the baggage out of the way. We talk about our life wanting to be one day at a time. It's kind of hard to live one day at a time when you're carrying 1972 with you too. And the fall of 1974 is what that guy said to me in 1966. Somehow these things ought to be cleared away so I can at least face today with today. And you can't always do it perfectly. Again and again, I just always try to stress to people that remember, we can't ever do it perfectly. And the irony of it is, the great fault of alcoholics is that they're perfectionists. Anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. First law. If it isn't perfect, why? They talk about alcoholics being perfectionists. I didn't used to identify that. I've never been a perfectionist. I just want things to be right, and if not, screw it. And it's a long thing to discover that we are not going to do things perfectly. We can't do it wonderfully. There's something in the 12 and 12 that's kind of funny about talking about spirituality, where it says we should never be satisfied with our spiritual condition. We shouldn't rest on our spiritual condition. Which gets back to that same old phenomenon in the book that sounds strange until you begin to realize what it means. The good is the enemy of the best. We stop halfway. As soon as the heat is reduced a little bit, because we're by nature easy wearers, and we stop a little bit. And it requires some use of a power greater than myself, of a God, if you will, that power to continue to do it. God works. An example that I like is that when you're going to make an amend to someone, that intimidates you and frightens you. I can see it now in retrospect. I wish I'd known at the time, but I can help other people with it sometimes. Or they're going to make a place where they used to work, and you're going to see this guy's office, and he's waiting for you. You know, he's going to grind you. You're going to go in there and say you're sorry. I'll tell you an example of that. When I was a senior at the University of Wisconsin, I was in the first class after the war started in 1946, and we were steely-eyed, sex-crazed veterans. That's our image. And we were wild and did a lot of things because we were scarred by the war. We played that to the hilt, I'll tell you. And I was on probation several times, but I'd won some trophies for the college. And when I was a senior, one night I was downtown drinking, and I ran into this traveling sales lady with a magazine firm. I told her about the trophies I'd won, and she didn't seem to believe it. So we went up to the university. I kicked open the door to the administration building. And I went in and showed her the trophies. And I was kind of drinking too much. I don't recall exactly what happened, but apparently I felt she had a flat tire because I was pumping her up there on the floor. And some policemen came in and illuminated this gory scene. I'll tell you something. If you ever want a quick cessation of sexual drive, you have a policeman flashlight. Quick detox. And in 1950, of course, they were a little less free in social custom than they are now. So they took us to jail. I was put in jail, and so was she. And the next morning, she went to court and got a $150 fine for disorderly conduct and a floater out of town. And I was held over the next day. And the next day, I got two things. Just before I went to court, I got a letter from the university saying, from the dean of students, saying, "Notice, this is your note of expulsion. You're expelled." And then he had written in a hand letter, "I worked time after time to protect you. All you had to do was go two more months. And I begged you to take care of yourself. But I told you not to drink it off and nonsense. You would not do it. You have broken your parents' heart. You've broken my heart. You've made me look a fool in this university. You made it look bad. It's all over the papers. We could file suit against you for breaking and entering in the nighttime to commit a felony, to wit, adultery. But we're not going to do that. Just stay away from this campus forever." Now, we'll jump ahead a few years. That was not an easy amend to go make, I'll tell you. He'd become president of the university by this time. And the same time I went to see my dad, I also went down there to see him. He would not see me. I told the secretary, I heard him say, "I'm not in. And tell him I'll never be into him." Well, that kind of cuts into your spiritual fervor, I'll tell you. I wonder what he'd say. "Oh, yeah? Are you into that? I'm here to tell you about God, you son of a bitch." But I came by the next time I was home. Funny, I call it home. And you always would still think it was home. I didn't live there all that long. But finally, after about 3 years of this, I called him on the phone, and he agreed from California. He said, "I'll be in Eau Claire. I wish you'd give me a chance to come and see you. I really got something to say." "No, I don't want anything from you."
"Oh, all right."
Because he was a very religious man. He was disappointed in me. He always had great hopes for me. And so when I went to his office, I was literally sweating. And the technique I know now, I didn't know then, but I'd recommend anybody in that situation: go across the hall, go in the washroom, stop for a minute. Remember that you're not going in there alone. You have God in your pocket. We are going in there. You can't be all that bad if we are going in there. I didn't know it then. So I went in, I told him what I tried to do, and what I was trying to do, and I was working in radio and television in Hollywood by this time, and it looked like my wife and children were going to move back with me eventually, and I was very sorry that I know I'd caused a great deal of problems. That's very interesting. I wish you well. Thank you very much. I'm busy now. And that was the end of that event. Well, next time I was back, 8 months later, I went down to see him again. Poor bastard. I'm sure he felt like a fawn in the forest fire. Every time he looked up, here comes this fool making amends again. Leave me alone. I forgive you, Jesus. But that was really hurting me. That had left a real scar. And that I talked to him at length. And then the next time I came back, I didn't come back to make an amend, but I said, "Can I just talk to you about something? I have an idea." He said, "I'm really busy." This was 6 months later. I said, "You know, if it isn't too much, I know it is a terrible thing to ask you. We're now in the 1960s. I said, "But would it be possible for me to get the alumni news bulletin? I know technically I'm not an alumnus, but just because I really have a deep feeling towards the school." "Oh, all right." He started sending me that. And I stayed. I saw him for most of a while. That's all. Most of the points done. Now we jump ahead to 1976. I'd seen him several times. I had gone back to speak at the annual dinner in my hometown of Eau Claire. They had it started off. They called it the Eau Claire Annual Coon Feed. And I was back there at the 10th Annual Coon Feed. I looked forward to that with a lot of anticipation. They gave you beef, but you know they called it, because they started off with coon some years before. And you know when they changed the name of it? About 2 years after that, after I was there, they had a lawyer from Chicago, a black lawyer, came up and spoke. And he started off by saying, "I don't know if you want me to talk, if you're going to eat me." But I don't know if he spoke, and he was invited. He'd never been to an AA meeting, and they'd invited. It's kind of funny, they invited the chief of police. Part of my talk, I'd be able to say, "I was one of his first arrests when he was a rookie." There's a feeling of continuity in that way, you know. I'll tell you something funny to you that may give you some hope if you're still going through any problems that I've discovered over the years. If you turn out well, all of those early things become amusing little legends. Remember that time? Oh, gosh. If you turn out badly, they're proof you always were a no good son of a bitch. It just depends on how you turn up. Because I go back and people chuckle and laugh about things 30 years ago, they wouldn't even talk to me on the street because of those same things. Now they're, "Remember that time?" Put their arms around you, feel like, "Get their hands off me." Now, if there's some end to this story, hopefully. I've incidentally been, I went up and spoke at the 20th annual banquet, the 25th annual banquet. And next year I'm going to speak at the 30th annual banquet. It's just wonderful. Just a local boy makes good rotten drunken puke with the first water. But anyway, 1978, I get a call from the University of Wisconsin from the dean secretary. She says, "We're having a big alumni get together scheduled in Los Angeles for the alumni that live in that area. And the guy that was in charge of it has disappeared. We don't know where he went. But we have no arrangements, no accommodations. And it's supposed to be in 2 weeks." And the dean thought, since you're kind of an operator. Me? Look at the holes in my palms. "And can you get us?" I said, "Sure I can. I got friends." I got him the Biltmore Hotel. Lovely, lovely room in the Biltmore. Call the master. "You're all set. Just tell him to come." And they were enthused. "You did such a good job in this. Would you like to join us?" I said, "Yes, I would." So I came, and
mixed with all these old alumni fools, and I'm glad to see all the members of my class look much older than I did. To me, they did. And the dean was there, this now president. He said, "Why? I can't, you know, if you couldn't see me several times, but I understand you're really doing pretty good." I said, "What are you doing now?" I said, "Well," he said, "I understand you're running some kind of a thing on Skid Row." I said, "Yeah, I am." He said, "Well, that's not like you, is it? To look out for anybody else. What's in it for you?" I said, "Well, just doing it." He said, "I'd like to come over and see it." I said, "Okay." So after the thing, we went over to the Skid Row. It was on Sunday afternoon. We walked up through this clean, sparkling place. One of the few missions in the world that doesn't smell like disinfectant and urine. It's clean and sparkling, but deals with just the dying men and women. And he saw the whole thing, all staffed by people who used to be classified hopeless people on the street. And he couldn't believe it. He said, "I can't believe this. I know it's true, there's your name on your desk, but you've really changed a little bit, haven't you?" "Well, I hope so, Prez." I felt just like I was back in being intimidated again. I hadn't felt that way in years. You know. I thought, sorry. So that's, he said, "Well, impressed me pretty much." That was the end of that. Now, we jump ahead a year. January 1980. Get a call from the University of Wisconsin. "Well, this is Miss Carlson from the alumni office. President is retiring this year, you know. He's retiring from the job. He's, I know that nice man. Glad, wish him well. Nothing I can do to, you want me to contribute towards going away, President? What is it you want me to do?" She said, "No, it's a strange thing. He has recommended that you be named our alumnus of the year and come and speak at our commencement." I said, "Okay," I said, "that's wonderful." She said, "Okay, we'll say," she sent me all the data. From the 1980, May, I was the distinguished alumnus of the year of the University of Wisconsin. And I brought all my children with me. And my parents were still alive. They were very old. They died soon thereafter. But my mother and my father, who hadn't lived together for many years, but they came together. And my kids were all there. And I spoke at commencement on the benefits of living a decent life. And I didn't want them to know that I had been expelled. We laughed about it later. I must be the only alumnus, the same alumnus in the history of the world, that was expelled from the institution. Didn't even graduate. Just, "Get out of here, you son of a bitch!" You know. That was really a touching moment. My parents cried. They cried when I got expelled, and they cried when I was alumnus of the institution. My children cried. I cried. I had a chance, as I told them, they didn't quite understand what I was talking about, but I said, "I've made amends for many things in my life, but this is one area I've never had a chance to make amends for. I want to make amends to this university." So after that, I got thinking about that a year later or so. And then I started writing funny little letters to the new dean and president. "You know, really appreciate this opportunity, but isn't it kind of bad to have a non-graduate to be your alumnus of the year?" And I did it in a joking way, but I kept grinding. 1986, they said, "Okay," and sent me a diploma. So now I'm a member of the class of 1986. I by far look the oldest of anyone in that class. But again, that's a long, tedious story. But again, that's an amend I never would have made. I would have been ashamed to go back and face that old guy. And the first time he saw me, I never would have gone back. I'll tell you that. I don't mean that every time you go back and make an amend, you're going to be an alumnus of the year, or you're going to get close to your father. But I'm sure that good things can happen. And if nothing else happens, you will lose the hatred for those people. You will lose the terrible separation. You, in a sense, take on, you lose your sense of isolation. You rejoin much of the human race, which is really what that step's about. And I think it's most appropriate. I know you've all heard this 100 times, but in that context, exactly what it says. He goes into it by saying, we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Then, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That is one of the great lines of all of AA. The very things that have made us guilty and terrible now are tools to help somebody else. You say you've been in the insane asylum? I have too. I'll follow you. The first guy I sponsored that stayed sober. I tried to sponsor several people, but I increased their drinking as far as I could tell. But this first guy, my 2 years sober, he's at his first meeting. He looked me up and he said, I'd like you to be my sponsor. I said, sure. And he became my sponsor. I became a sponsor. He stayed sober. Later, he told me why he wanted me to be his sponsor. Why do you think? Because he didn't have any front teeth, and I didn't have any front teeth. And I was sober 2 years without front teeth, and he realized it's not necessary to have front teeth. He understands. You might say, you may wonder how long I went without front teeth. I should describe that. When I was 2 years sober, I got this job in the medical corporation. And I said to my sponsor, well, I've got some money put aside now. I'm going to be an executive. I'm going to be a writer in the advertising department. I'm going to get some front teeth. He said, for Christ's sake, send that money to your kids in Dallas. They have so little. I said, I send them money every chance I get. So you just haven't sent them enough. You got enough to buy front teeth. They just bought. They all got front teeth. I'll show you their picture. Something to do with front teeth. Something to do with your attitude. You're a selfish thing. Send them the goddamn money. So I send them the money. With graciousness and love, of course. I wasn't mad at them. I was mad at that old fool. And I learned to carry my lip like this. So I don't think anybody in that company ever knew I didn't have front teeth. I guess they thought I was burned in the fire, you know. But I went to work every day and I did the things and eventually I got some front teeth. Now I tell newcomers that, I may have said maybe the provincial, I don't know if I did that, but I lost my teeth. Now I've, like our book says, we're like men who have lost their front teeth and never grow new ones. I often tell them, if you're concerned about losing teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become like me, spiritually transformed and almost holy, they grow back.